Hello and welcome to a brand new show because God knows I needed another show on the Jedi Cole universe. This is, as you know if you've read the title of course, BS with SB, which could mean almost anything, but in this case it's a lot of just BSing with my great friend from Australia, Mr. Stuart Balk.
How many show you got now, man?
I got more show than you can ever listen to, man.
Well, you can shake a spider web at, man. Again, everyone, this is on the fly. I promise you, I just, yeah, Cole being Cole, there's no short of surprises with him. So if I sound a bit dazed and confused, it's nature doing that. And also, I'm a bit rattled.
It's solely because Stu knows that I'm ever poised by the mic in case anyone ever, you know, just like, hey, why don't we record a show right now?
So this I like to think of Cole as sort of the Henry Rollins of podcasting. He's always got a mic in his hand.
That's right. Yeah, the first Henry Rollins reference of whatever year we're in.
Wow, that was the first USG reference of this entire show. and probably not the last if we continue to pull this off.
Yeah.
Essentially, what this show is all about is we're sitting around talking earlier, thinking, why don't we just do a show and just, you know, the kind of just BSing we would normally do anyway. And who knows, we may take a page from my many other shows and have a guest one of these days, but it's unlikely.
No.
It depends on if anybody else wants to actually BS with SB.
I don't think anybody could actually get a word in edgewise, because I'm full of BS, as everybody who knows me knows.
Oh, okay. Well, that just, you know, I don't blame you for drinking before doing a show with me. Most people find it does help soften the blow.
No, that's later on tonight.
So I'm Pepsi catching you pre-beer? What's wrong with you?
Yeah, it's totally 10 to 3 in the afternoon here. It's a bit early. I mean, got 10 minutes yet before I start drinking.
I was going to say, only just.
It's a warm, very, very warm day in Melbourne today. Yeah, I apologize as well, listeners, if there's the sound of generic, crappy rock music wafting in the background. They are literally building on top of my house as we do this show. I've just managed to find a very, very quiet spot somehow in this house.
Do you have like a bunker or something? No, yeah, Rick. Rick has a bunker, I'd say. So conceptually, this was just sort of going to be a casual kind of BS show, but at the same time, there needs to be some slight structure. So we're gonna lead in this time, this outing with movies, because Australian, have the enviable ability to, as we speak, go to the cinema and see Thor: The Dark World, while those of us in America, the country that actually produced the fucking film, have to wait.
Yeah, but you forget the lead star is Australian, so he's got a lot of clout these days. But then again, the first Thor did a premiere in Australia 2 weeks before America got it.
Exactly. At least this time they're giving it just 1 week for Australians to spoil it all for us instead of 2 weeks.
Hell, we got Iron Man 3 on home video a month before America as well. Marvel must love Australia, I think.
Well, the problem that you run into a lot of times, and this is a good example of something that gets under my skin sometimes, is you get this sort of courtship with foreign countries that occurs with American companies. That, you know, as a Star Wars fan and collector, I'm like, why does Pepsi hate America? I mean, apart from putting Pepsi on the market.
Well, I mean, they did try to burn an American icon, didn't they? Michael Jackson back in the mid-80s?
Oh, that's right. They did try to torch Michael Jackson.
Didn't do a very good job, but I mean, they got some part of him at least.
Well, you know, it's when you try to branch out and do things like Assassination by Fire. It's kind of like, it's their new Coke. No, I'm sorry, their new Coke was Crystal Pepsi. So needless to say, this will also be an exercise in my mind jumping all over the place more so than normal.
So it's just a normal conversation with you, Colin, is it?
I know, and Stu is one of the few who's managed to survive them and adapt.
I actually look forward to them, let's say that much.
Well, excellent.
Yeah.
But we're kind of winding our way back from the precipice that is Crystal Pepsi to Thor. Other than just to point out that what I'm getting on about Pepsi about and about this sort of courtship with other countries is, like, PepsiCo for years, like during Star Wars promotions, like to get Japanese people to drink Pepsi or at least buy Pepsi. You know, they may have just bought it and poured it out if they were smart. In Japan especially, and possibly in other Asian markets, they would put out, like, Pepsi that had cool little figurines built onto the bottle caps. And it wasn't just Star Wars stuff. It was I actually had a little figurine from the remake of Planet of the Apes that had...
Jeez!
Yeah, and it's really cool because the thing's almost too big to be on the top of the Pepsi bottle, on the cap.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, you know, it must be annoying in convenience stores unless you just can't buy the stuff refrigerated. The extra height they have to allow for.
Is it like a Dr. Zay's bottle opener, is it?
I think it's the... I don't know if they... I can't remember if they changed the names or anything on that remake, but it was the general that... what's his name? Green Mile guy played?
That is
sad. But, I mean, the figurine, he's like sitting astride his horse... And the thing's nearly 2 inches tall above the height of the cap.
Wow.
And the 4 feet, the hooves of the horse, are spaced where they're just, like, hanging on the edge of the cap itself. So this thing is, you know, protruding in opposite directions off the surface and up. And it's like, good night, how difficult is it to market this stuff and merchandise it in the store? But we'll never know here in America, because Pepsi's not going to put jack shit on the cap of a Pepsi bottle. Thank you very much.
I'll tell you what, Cole. You guys might be devoid of toys on top of your Pepsi bottles. Okay? And we may get them here. And
well,
I don't care
true.
That. I would trade every Pepsi top toy, whatever the hell you want to call them, to get my beloved Snapple back. Any day.
Yes.
And as you know, you and Catherine stocked up the damn fridge of Snapple for me when I stayed with you guys.
We did. It was like the Snaffleverse there for a while.
Oh, that's fantastic. It was enough to stop me from going from, you know, all 55 cans that Cole and Catherine bought for me in about the space of 2 days. But
we're just like, feel free. We don't have any beer, but by God, we got Snapple.
Yeah. But anyway, come back to Thor, as you were saying.
Yeah, the reason I bring Thor up, in addition to the fact that Australia get to have it a week earlier than we do because Marvel are a bunch of bastards and like Australia best, and Chris Hemsworth's in it, you know. And I don't know, did you get Iron Man any earlier than we do, or do we get to keep our Tony Stark?
We got him, I think, a week later in the States.
Oh, so yeah, I guess that's how it works, you know.
Yeah, I believe with Thor, the first one that came out 2011, they actually brought it out to Australia first, not because they like Australia better, but they actually tested the market with it. It was an untried character in any sort of live-action setting. So they threw it out here for 2 weeks to see how it went. And, you know, Chris Hemsworth being an Australian lad, it was heavily promoted, very heavily promoted here. It was just...
So actually they put it out there early on the off chance that you would see it. And then if people would look and say, well, I wonder if Stuart Balk hates this movie as well.
Well, you know my vehement disgust or dislike I had for it before it even premiered.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I actually, I mean, it was well noted, and I made no bones about it. But I remember, you know, going with yourself and Catherine and Rick and the USG crew, Sans Andy, of course, sadly, and watching and just, wow, really, really enjoyed it. Enough to the point where I did buy it on Blu-ray when it came out, and in the 3D, which We didn't see it in 3D. We saw it in 2D. And
that's because we were cheap.
And you know what? The extra $3 or $4 we would have saved, it would have been worth it because you really didn't get much. You got a bit of depth of field, but nothing, you know, come at you in 3D.
Yeah, I mean, I had to save some money for Snapple.
And then we were going to Jake's that night later on.
That's right. Yes, we did.
To save money for burgers and beer and all that gear.
But, yeah, for those of you who are confused about what's going on here, in 2011, Stu graced the Americas with his presence, making a...
Well, I visited. I wouldn't say grace. I'd say I visited anyway.
we let him in and promptly let him back out again.
Yeah. So, yeah, Thor in 3D was okay, but, I mean, I watch it these days, and I will be watching it tonight in preparation to watch Thor. I was in 2D tonight when I later on.
But yeah, I enjoyed that's rather the point is, you know, you came here with this, you know, vehement disregard for Thor right out of the box, and then kind of got shanghaied into attending a screening. It was sort of like, you know, begrudgingly.
Well, I was always going to put my hand up and say I'd watch it with you guys because I could have seen it back here. I think I had 7 or 8 days here before I was leaving to fly to America. And I said, no, I won't. I said I'd watch it with the USG crew, so I'll do it then. I'll just wait off.
Oh, absolutely. But it's kind of like being drugged to a chick flick, you know. It's like you'll do it out of...
Yeah.
You came out in solidarity, even though it wasn't something you really would have sought out yourself. So I was very pleased that it turned out to be a positive experience, so...
Well, I think my real problem was with it was the casting of Hemsworth as Thor. I'm like, because as I've mentioned before many times, I'd seen him on TV here in soap operas. I'm like, he's not going to play Thor, you know, because Thor's a character I love very, very much in the old, Cole, remember those cartoons from 66, 67, the 5 minute, 6 minute shorts?
Yes, the very rudimentary cartoons.
Yes, where it was just comic panels with the mouth. Superimposed over the top.
Very, very raw form of animation, but I own all those on DVD.
Ah.
And yeah, England actually was the only place that released them. I got them while they were, you know, still hot on the market, and then they disappeared, and, you know, you're selling body parts, and they'll actually pick up one of those, especially the damn, I think it's the Captain America one, just goes for a stupid amount of money, which, you know, I do thankfully have, but, I watched those, and I always liked Thor because I always liked the theme song. I mean, I liked all the theme songs, but I really liked Thor.
Yeah, oddly enough, the Thor one didn't get much airtime here back when one of the local stations in Texas was showing some of those. You saw a lot of Hulk and Spider-Man and occasionally Fantastic Four. I think there was one, and maybe once in a blue moon they'd fart out a Namor.
You see Namor... Namor, I only know from you guys. I would never have heard of it otherwise. Fantastic Four, wasn't that late 70s? I believe it was a 78. Or was there a 60s one of that as well?
There might have been. Because, you know, Thor is... I was amazed just going back to the movie when it came out in 2011 that seemed like an odd choice because Thor, to me, always seemed like the least marketable of the Marvel heroes.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they kind of needed him to exist so they could do Avengers.
Yeah, but did he need to be part of the Avengers is what I've been questioning pretty much since the concept of the Avengers film was first put out there to the general public. Was Thor literally one of the Avengers? I know Captain America definitely was.
Thor was actually, he was a charter Avenger, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
Yeah, the Avengers in the comics, when they first appeared... actually fought Loki. Their first adventure was, that's how they formed, is I guess the Thor and Loki were, you know, pissing in each other's cornflakes or something and took the fight to Earth. And Iron Man, the original trash can version.
Yeah.
The Incredible Hulk back in his Frankenhulk days. And Wasp and Ant-Man comprised the original Avengers. Captain America actually didn't come along until later, because up to that point, he had been existing. This was like in the 60s, probably, and Captain America, for all intents and purposes, was a hero from the 40s. And I think they literally finagled the whole Frozen and Ice thing as a way to get the character back in circulation.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was the Avengers were running around in a submarine that they had or got off of somebody or something at one point, and came across the, as I recall, I remember reading a thing about how apparently Namor had, you know, there he is again, had stumbled on the frozen remains of Captain America that this Eskimo or Inuit tribe were worshiping as a god. And that apparently offended his Atlantean sensibilities, so he cracked off that chunk of ice and tossed it into the Bering Straits or wherever they were, and it went floating along, partially thawing out, and then the Avengers are cruising along in a submarine for some reason, like, oh, look, there's a piece of ice that looks like it's got Captain America inside, because it's a piece of ice with Captain America inside.
It sounds like that, who's that guy on One of the Levels of Hell? Is it Dante?
Yeah, Dante's Inferno.
Dante's Inferno, yeah. Sounds like encased in ice.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think it was Dante's Inferno.
So, anyway. Oddly enough, Captain America is kind of odd man out when you're jumping into the Avengers, and Hawkeye, for that matter, and Black Widow, and... So they kind of took some cues from the origins of the Avengers, but didn't necessarily, you know, Ant-Man and Wasp might have been a little hard to swallow right off the bat.
Oh, God, yeah. Swing it back around to Thor.
Oh, I see what you did there, too, swinging.
Ah, you picked up on it, right?
Like the hammer.
That's right. So I don't know if this time around, with it being released the week early here, whether you're testing the marketing. I think it's pretty much tried and tested with the first one. I think the first one made a lot of money. Whether it was the most popular of the individual titles, save for Iron Man, which was just made a truckload of money. I think it made more than Captain America. Captain America was sort of dismissed as, you know, a ho-hum effort. I mean, I'll probably watch part two and see what it's like, but I wasn't enamored with the first Captain America. It was okay.
I know you've pretty well gone on record that just didn't do it for you.
I mean, I will give it another watch one day. You know,
the couple of days before you go see the second one.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I need to keep myself up to speed, because if I go watch Thor the Dark World tomorrow night, whatever it is, you know, I'll need to keep myself up to speed, otherwise I'll be like, oh, hang on, what happened from the end of part one again? Oh, that's right, yeah, that's right. The portal and all that sort of stuff.
In a lot of ways, Captain America suffered more for his origin than anybody else in the theatrical series so far. Other than Hulk, who suffered through that god-awful Ang Lee version.
On that god-awful Edward Norton one, it was just unwatchable. I mean, I own it, and... you know, I'll probably watch it again, but it was a tough watch. They've never gotten the Hulk right in film. They've never gotten the Hulk right.
I don't know. I think the Avengers was the first time somebody took the right approach.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you hear it first on the Jedi Cog Universe. I'm starting to warm to that film slowly. Don't blow it.
I think it's peer pressure, actually.
I don't suffer from that. I stand my ground, as you know.
That's true.
But yeah, but I am starting to slowly warm to it. And damn you, Rick, for sending me that 3D copy in the mail. Thanks, mate. But I am actually, I'm slowly coming around. I think with the Avengers, and I won't go on about it too long, just about a minute or so. It's that the fact that there was so much hoopla around it and hype and fanboy gasm and, you know, death threats to people who weren't fond of it, and I copped a bit of abuse for it back on the Midnight Movie Cowboys plug, where I was pretty vehement pretty vehement in my dislike for it. And, you know, I copped a bit of abuse, saying, what's wrong with this effing idiot and stuff like that. But, you know, I pushed that aside. That was, what, a year and a half ago now, a year ago.
Well, you know, and, I think a lot of it, really, the movie itself, just sort of, you know, if you can, as an American audience goer, remove yourself from being an American audience goer for a minute, I can really see where you're coming from, because it is a very American film, if that makes any kind of sense.
It does make sense.
Because it very much speaks to American sensibilities, and there's a lot of things that we're so accustomed to here that we don't realize don't play well everywhere. And being a Joss Whedon vehicle, it's chock-a-block full of that kind of modern American referencing the living hell out of everything.
See, that's where I kind of had a bit of a problem with it. And I don't preach against this practice, but it's seen a lot of a flag-waving film. It seemed like a real flag-waving, you know, yay America sort of thing. And like I said, I don't condone that sort of thing, but when a film's that big, you need to play to every audience, to everywhere in the world. You're not going to please everybody. But another thing I found wrong with that was it seemed, I don't know, Cole, let me know what you think. Did it seem very jam-packed to you, like they tried to cram everything but the kitchen sink?
You know, the funny thing is, the difficulty that's always been there with doing like the superhero group film, the team film, or just doing a film with a lot of superheroes in it.
Is
how much can you cram in and still tell a viable story? In the superhero genre, I think the shining example of this going terribly wrong was Batman and Robin. And I'm talking beyond the nipples on the costume. I'm talking about, you had
a credit card.
What shouldn't have been an unwieldy cast of characters that turned into an unwieldy cast of characters.
Oh, but that was just one big toy advert. That's all.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was just a big flamboyant clusterfuck.
Oh, absolutely.
With no real story in it.
Let me ask you this, Cole. I haven't got your answer, or I haven't sort of heard what your idea was on this. What do you reckon about all the backlash about Ben Affleck being Batman?
Oh, you know, that's a good one, because we were talking about doing a retro show of Hey Kids Comics.
Right.
Where we would pretend like there was the internet and stuff like that back when Tim Burton was doing Batman.
Oh, that's a good idea.
So we're going to do this retro show where it's like it had been recorded back then, and we're talking about how, what an awful choice of, you know, why Tim Burton, and who's this guy? He's like, did some movie called Frankenweenie. Why are they giving him Batman? And casting Michael Keaton with Mr. Mom?
Why they casting Mr. Mom, yeah, that's right. Why are they casting Bill Blazkowski or whatever his name is in Night Shift?
Exactly. So, you know, come on, man. He's an idea man. He's not a Batman.
Yeah.
And that's for you fans of Night Shift who can put that obscure reference together. But
let me just say this. I will say this. All of you think that Michael Keaton's a bad actor, I think I say you're full of BS. Because you watch that guy in lots of films, and especially Night Shift, he was outstanding in that film.
Well, also, if you look at him in dramas, I mean, good God, what was that? Pacific Heights.
That was Melanie Griffith. That wasn't a bad one. One I really liked him was one called Clean and Sober, where he played a recovering alcoholic.
I've not seen that, but I know that was one of his more acclaimed roles as well.
It was. That was one of his ones from the, I want to say, 89 or 90, around that area, that time frame there. But yeah, good, solid little movie. Also one called Desperate Measures that he did with, I want to say, Andy Garcia as well. I think that may have been the one I'm thinking. But yeah, Michael Keaton, damn fine actor. Damn good actor, that guy. So
I think what you were suffering from back then was his body of work was comedy.
Oh, without a doubt. Beetlejuice,
Well, you know, he was very well known from Night Shift and especially from Mr. Mom. So that was the sorts of things that were being bandied about at the time.
Yeah.
And either people forget or more likely what we're looking at is a whole new generation of Keaton haters. Except now they're Affleck haters.
I mean, you know, bringing back around to Affleck, I just found that vile, you know, mountain of hate for Affleck as Batman just absolutely sickening. It was like it was the Avengers all over again. I thought, the guy's an actor, and the guy's a good actor. And I'll tell you why. I mean, apart from the very, he's made some dumb films. No doubt about it, you know. Forces of Nature, well, I liked it. You know, all those rom-coms he did, Geely or whatever it is.
Reindeer Games.
I saw him in Hollywood. I didn't mind Reindeer Games. I never have disliked that film. It was a bit of a mess, but that was more in the editing. It was never to do with the performances, really. But I saw him in Hollywoodland the other day, where he played George Reeves, and the film based around the death of George Reeves. And he was really, really good. I was so taken with him in that film that I thought, well, you know, here's a guy, but people don't really know. He's played Superman, and now he's playing Batman. How many people can really claim to that?
That's true. I think what you're running into here is the same thing with Keaton, where you have an actor with a very large body of work, and people are zeroing in on the wrong things.
I'll tell you what they zeroed in on, Cole. He played Daredevil. That film sucked. No, Daredevil, the theatrical film, wasn't very good. Daredevil, the director's cut, was a good, good movie.
Oh, I'll have to look at that.
Haven't you seen the director's
cut? No, I haven't. I've seen the original cut, and it was like watching a made-for-TV movie or something. It had all that kind of sensibility.
Dismiss that theatrical. It doesn't exist. Watch the director's. It is a vastly different film.
Ah. So that and one about really another suffered. And the thing is that Daredevil is one of those that's going to suffer by comparison to the more contemporary films when Marvel Films was created.
Yeah.
Because it was one of the last films that wouldn't likely have been in the Marvel Films catalog that got made by when Marvel was just like writing licenses, like bring us a truckload of money and you can do whatever you want with our characters.
Yeah.
Then they realized that a lot of what was happening was really sucky stuff, and maybe it wasn't just about the money.
That's right. Well, I mean, the guy who did Daredevil, what was it, Mark Steven Johnson, also did Ghost Rider. So, I don't know if it's characters that are the fault. It's the actual, maybe it might be the writer and director. But then again, like I said, backtracking, I said Daredevil, director's cut, was a very, very good film. Ghost Rider, you know,
I haven't actually seen either of the Ghost Rider films, nor have I seen the second Punisher.
Oh, man, the second Punisher is just, it's just brutal. It's just body parts flying everywhere and blood. It's a brutal movie.
Is it Sam Peckinpah's Punisher?
It may as well have been. It really is the Punisher the way the Punisher should have been. Except I heard somebody once say that the Punisher who's eaten a lot of pies and fast food, you know, he's a bit portly, the Punisher in this one, but because it's the Punisher the way it's meant to be, not the Punisher Don Travolta one where...
Well, you know, he probably drowned the sorrow of losing his family in a brutally violent situation by, you know, crying into the odd Big Mac.
It's like, you know, that plate of nuggets will just probably help.
Oh, exactly.
Help, you know,
I mean, by comparison, as a superhero, Wolverine, half the time, he's like out in the woods and stuff, living on, for our Australian audience, Bush Tucker. And, you know, he's a very active superhero. Where Punisher spends a lot of time, like, researching his targets and cleaning his guns. And we're talking about a lot of sedentary time here. So it's little wonder he's a little soggy around the midsection.
Well, Let me pose this question to you, Cole. All right?
Okay.
Have you ever thought why Wolverine's so angry all the time?
It's funny because he's Canadian and not Australian. No.
Have you thought it might have been a lot of pent-up sexual frustration? Look at it. The guy can't masturbate.
That's true.
For the obvious reasons. Okay, so he can't do that.
Even without the claw risk, the adamantium... It makes your hands really chilly.
And, I mean, the only person he can touch, I mean, the only female really is, what's her name, Rogue.
Yeah.
And as soon as she touches, he's stuffed, so.
You know, I hadn't really thought about it. I hadn't psychoanalyzed him before, but I would have, you know, put it up to, you know, his longevity and the mental anguish from outliving everyone you know, or the many, you know, the death of anyone he ever gets close to, that those sort of psychological triggers. But really, it does actually, when you get right down to it, it comes down to sexual frustration.
I think so, yeah.
Or maybe, also, you know, might have been he could get somebody to build him a machine or something, or get one of those fleshlights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You could.
It's warmer than adamantium. Yes. This show we're going to mention in passing, Thor the Dark World, has now turned into the non-existent sex life of Wolverine.
This show is only just started. It's like Dante's Inferno. I think we've gotten to the first level. We've got another six levels of goats, you know.
That's why we're making it a series. This is our slow progression into hell.
6 degrees from nonsensical jargon, I think it is.
Actually, you know, I have not had that much fun with Wolverine in a long time.
People say he's angry as well because he watched his first film and didn't like it.
That would piss anybody. I was like, I went from X-Men to this?
Ah, but you know, I love it. I've seen it about 5 times.
I've never got past the first time because there were just so many bones of contention. No, and nor were they adamantium laced or bone claws for that matter.
You did that watch the. You ever see the second one?
I did indeed. I actually enjoyed the second one a lot more. It's not a.
I've heard it's a lot better. Yeah,
it is considerably better. Is it a solid film on the level of a lot of these more recent movies? Not so much. Excellent Easter egg at the end. A little cookie at the end for you.
Don't tell me.
But you know, going from the first one to the second one, then you know, that elevates it up a great many degrees. The script is, again, it's one of the hardest things I think that screenwriters have with these characters is they don't know exactly what to do with them in their downtime.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Wolverine in the X-Men films was great, but to carry a whole film, it's like people say, oh, I want a Rogue film. I want a Jean Grey film. It's not going to play.
No.
It wouldn't work. This is somebody who doesn't read comics, you know, who even knows this stuff. I mean, I watch films, but I don't read comics, and I don't have as much of the back story or mythology of these characters, but even I would know. Like, people were saying when the Avengers came out, oh, what a Hawkeye film. Why? It's just, it wouldn't play.
No, at least money. Not without some considerable development. We're going to need at least 3 Avengers under your belt and maybe do what they're doing with Black Widow and carry him over into some more movies.
You know, Black Widow's for the male audience, really. I mean, you can put Scarlett Johansson in a film and every guy's going to flock out to watch it.
Yeah, I'll be right back. I've got to go see a Scarlett Johansson film.
Back in 2 hours.
That's right. All I can say is thank God I'm not Wolverine.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave it at that. But, you know, I think, though, that's one of the strengths of the Marvel Studios films is that they are, you know, weaving threads throughout all of the movies.
Mm.
And that allows a greater sort of cinematic universe to emerge that you didn't and wouldn't have otherwise. I mean, there isn't that kind of synergy between the first, second, and third Spider-Man films. And they all had the same director.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
And it really brings up, I may have brought this up probably repeatedly on other shows, I may not have. One of the things I would dearly love to see in a superhero film is the suggestion of characters you don't get to see developed. Like,
that brings up my point exactly. what would you say if they said, okay, in 2015 we're doing a Super Friends film? I'd be all over it. So I grew up on that, watching it.
Well, you know, naturally I would flock to anything that had Aquaman in it.
With... Yeah, but I'm not just saying Aquaman. I get what you're saying, because you got in that you had... Now, I've got a lot of Super Friends cartoons. I taped off cable. I'm just trying to think who was in it. You had the Flash, didn't you?
But, you know, for me, the two things that will get me into the cinema is Scarlett Johansson and Aquaman.
What about Scarlett Johansson as Aquaman?
I'd be there as well. Are you kidding? I'd bring the Fleshlight. Oh.
Who would you cast, Cole, as Aquaman?
Aquaman. Wow, that's a good question, because I really, you know, I can't think of anybody just right off the top of my head.
Jack Black.
Yes, indeed. No, I would cast Jack Black as, like, the Buoy Wonder.
Oh, God.
Just give him a red and white suit and a bell on his head. Toss him in the ocean.
Yeah. So I can't think of anybody, because you have to have a... You know who I think would probably play it? Would be... And he'd be too young for it, but would be that James Franco.
Yeah, you know, I was about to say, what's his name? Clive Owen.
Clive Owen. Everybody just wants Clive Owen and everything. James Bond or Clive Owen? Aquaman, Clive Owen.
Actually, the thing about it is, if you watch Clive Owen in Sin City, that's who I would have cast as John Carter.
Okay.
Because as much as I wanted to love John Carter, I didn't love the casting.
Right. And how about John Travolta as Aquaman?
But, you know, I really would have put Clive Owen in that role if you could get him, because I think that, to me anyway, he embodied what John Carter ought to have looked like, acted like, been like.
Yeah.
But, you know, back in the day, I would, back when Watchmen was first out, and if Andrew listens to this, he's rolling his eyes right now, because he always gives me a hard time if Watchmen comes up in anything. But...
Oh, shut up.
When that was actually looking like, you know, studios were optioning it, I thought De Niro would have been the perfect comedian.
Not now, though.
No, not now, but if you back then, because Brazil was still kind of new, if you look at Harry Tuttle, that's Edward Blake.
Yeah, but for someone as yourself who latched on to Watchmen pretty much straight away, didn't you? Back in 85, 84, before it came out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember, God, I wrote this huge article on back when Columbia had the option. And I think Paul Greengrass was directing. Is that right?
Oh, no.
Yeah, and God, everything I read about it was just, I was cringing. And, you know, I hate to say it, normally I don't applaud natural disasters as being beneficial, but the fact that flooding in Prague killed that project was probably the best thing that ever happened to Watchmen.
Sorry to the people in Prague who lost family members there, but
Watchmen at least got saved. For all the loss of life and property, at least you could take some solace in knowing that...
I think Dr. Manhattan could have saved him, but he just chose not
to. That's right. This film sucks. I'm not even going to try. But, you know, one of the things that Columbia did something that Warner's didn't, and that was have a committed website with forums. Warner's had a website, but the neat thing is they had fan forums. And I actually went on there and wrote this entire article, it turned out. It started out as a post. Positing Dr. Manhattan as the principal character of Watchmen.
Right.
And, you know, immediately, being the internet, the idiot friends who don't bother to read what you've written, start flaming in. Oh, it's, you know, Rorschach's the principal character. How stupid are you? He's the main one. He's in nearly every panel of nearly every, like, shut up. I'm not talking about what you see. I'm talking about if you read the article instead of just the first sentence, you would have seen that he's crucial, that none of the rest of it happens without Dr. Manhattan, literally.
That's right.
But
I mean, people have to probably put an argument for there might have been Ozymandias would have been one of the principal characters, because without him, we wouldn't have gotten to the conclusion we got to. But
of course, without Dr. Manhattan, there is no none of the social relevant the socially relevant concerns exist, nor does a solution.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, Dr. Manhattan's presence drives almost everybody, if not everybody's, existence to some degree. Rorschach's mask is a product of technologies derived from Dr. Manhattan's understanding of physics. That there is a second generation of superheroes is because of the presence of Dr. Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
The owlship is very much incumbent on Dr. Manhattan derived technologies. The comedian's semi-retirement discovery of Ozymandias' plot. Everything literally revolves around Dr. Manhattan in some degree.
Cole, can I tell you something? I think you've read this too many times. You've dug in way too much information.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I've read the series, I would wager to say, 60 or 70 times. I read it several times a year. And I still discover things I never noticed.
I was just going to ask you, do you still pick up things after the 65th time that you think, oh, I didn't pick it up the other 64 times?
In that case, I do. It is that well done.
It is an amazing book. I remember you saying to me, you've got to read Watchmen, read the graphic novel. And I did pick up, I went out and bought it, and I remember just saying what a revelation of a book it was, and an amazing piece of work. I mean, I can't look at the film now without thinking, geez, I think they've done this wrong, and I wish they had done that, and that ending, and kept me on that, the end of that ending, you know. But, I mean, I don't dislike the film, I still like it.
No, I enjoy the film. There are parts that to me are cringeworthy because they weren't necessary.
Yeah, the language and the overtly sexual fight in the lane where I remember you saying about that one.
Yeah, they overdid the alley fight. It lost the poignancy because they went with, you know, blood and guts and.
Yeah, well, they had to sort of wrap that stuff up for the audience, because I remember my cousin watching it, and she just said, this is the stupidest film I've ever seen. I said, you don't know what you're talking about. You need to read the book. She goes, oh, it's a cheap Batman ripoff. I said, nah, you don't know what you're talking about. All right? Stupid bitch. You haven't got a clue.
What the hell you say?
Yeah. But let me ask you this, and I may have asked you before in the past, but if I have, I apologize. I've read Tales of the Black Freighter. I've watched the animated thing that came out as well. I can't see the correlation between what's going on in that subtale to the main story. Is it there, or is it just more gone berserk?
I think it has a bit of... its connection is rather tenuous, and I know that they did a cut where it tries to intertwine that into the film.
Yeah.
And on film, I don't think it works as well as it did in the comic. What it did, ultimately, is it parallels, in a way, the psychology of Ozymandias.
All right.
If you really overanalyze it like I do everything, what you see is a good man gone bad out of a sense of trying to protect family and life and well-being. And it really goes back to, in the comics, you know, the title of each issue was derived from either a pop culture song. There was like a Hendrix song that was one of the titles was derived from, and there was a biblical verse that one of the titles was derived from, and one of the titles is it was during the period that Rorschach was in jail, and the one that really explores him as a human being, as a person, rather than just the character, the costume. And the title of the issue was The Abyss Gazes Also, which, if memory serves, and it probably does, it was derived from a quote from Nietzsche that was, "Battle not with monsters, lest ye become a monster. And when you gaze into the abyss gazes also into you."
Okay.
And I think that really the purpose of Black Freighter, in addition to just helping build the universe, which is one thing Watchmen does brilliantly, is it says effectively, this isn't the world you know, and we're going to fill it with products and technologies and things that don't exist in the real world, and Nixon's still president. So, these are the things that allow you to get into an immersive world, almost like the Star Wars universe, where even though it's the familiar, there's enough unfamiliar there. So the Black Freighter was to illustrate that in a world where you actually have real superheroes, comic books have to be about something escapist. And to a large degree, it was also a nod to the old pre-code EC horror stuff, like your old, Tales from the Crypt and Nasty Murdering Axe Killer Fiesta.
Yeah.
Part of that immersive world was to see that you have pirate comics. In fact, it's sort of mentioned in some of the other material that makes up the kind of world-building backstory, that pirate and probably detective, like proper police comics and things like that, would thrive. But at the end of the day, that story about a good man who... It becomes that sort of, whom gods destroy, they first drive mad.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like an Ahab, the obsession that this guy has with beating the Black Freighter to his town. And he's so blinded by vengeance that it becomes the very thing he's fighting against.
Okay.
And philosophically, that's the conundrum for Adrian Veidt is... The only way he can combat the evils of society is to become literally more evil. And in that sense, that's really the relevance that exists for that. Because beyond that, it really doesn't serve a purpose. Does it drive the story? No. It gives you an interlude. It gives you an opportunity to have a means by which to literally park yourself at that news vendor stand and be a part of the non-relationship between
the become like that little kid reading the...
And that becomes very important at the end when there's no one else in their world at the end of their world.
That's right. After the Watt has pretty much destroyed all of New York.
The squid from beyond.
Let me ask you something. What's the, I don't know if we've spoken about before, but we'll bring up for all intents and purposes of this. What's the trade paperback, let's say the trade paperback is a compendium of Alan Moore's Swamp Thing like? I remember you saying it was vastly different from the films and...
Oh, much, much different. In fact, in many ways, much different from what the character became years before, for some reason, they brought him on. In fact, what was interesting is Swamp Thing kind of got retrofitted into the Vertigo imprint, where it didn't... it's one of the, I think, the only, if not one of the only, if not the only Vertigo title that didn't start out as a Vertigo title. But it was a good fit because it kind of took place more or less outside the mainstream DC universe, even though Moore was shrewd enough to bring the DCU into the story from time to time if it worked. What's interesting with that is he took a character that already existed and did what Moore does more brilliantly than anyone, and that's find a way to take what's already there and make it better and take it beyond the obvious. And what he did with this character, who for all intents and purposes was, okay, you got your scientist, he's working, you know, much like in the movie, he's working on his serum, he gets blowed up and he jumps in the swamp, and the combination of whatever that serum is and the indigenous swamp life create this, you know, vegetable creature that then stalks the swamp seeking revenge and a hopeful cure.
Yeah.
Well, not to give too much away, but Moore took that and said, okay, that's bullshit. And then he takes this character on a journey of discovery to find out that there's more than met the eye. And most of his adventures up to this point have been chasing down a self-imposed lie. And he introduced the character John Constantine. It was actually, though the first appearance of the character was in Crisis on Infinite Earths in a single panel, the real introduction of the character happened in Swamp Thing, and he later was spun off into his own book, Hellblazer.
That's not the same Constantine who Keanu Reeves played in the film,
was
it?
That is the same, and yet it is not the same. In so much as the character Constantine that Keanu Reeves played was based on the Vertigo title character, but only very loosely.
Okay.
At least insofar as
what
I know. Because in the comics, Constantine was a dead ringer for Sting. And frankly, who I would have cast, but...
Yeah.
You know, every now and again, it's funny because there's often this sort of deliberate dead ringer thing going on in comics. Oh, what was that that god-awful Wanted that made the god-awful movie? With Angelina Jolie?
Yeah.
So, the comic in that of that one, the original comic... The principal character was a dead ringer for Eminem, the rapper.
Oh, God.
And that prompted a lot of people when they heard, oh, it's going to be made into a movie. Everybody was like, yeah, you got to cast Eminem. You got to cast Eminem. I didn't really care. But the reason Nick Fury is played by Samuel L. Jackson in all these Marvel films, I think, is very much a conceit to the fact when Marvel launched their Ultimates series, where they basically... The Ultimates was a way to, like, let's start over from scratch on all of our top titles.
Right.
So you had Ultimate Spider-Man. It literally allowed you to have a Peter Parker instead of being an adult who's married and a college professor and occasionally takes the odd picture and beats up bad guys, to go back to Peter Parker, awkward teenager who gets superpowers. It allowed you to make an Avengers that made more sense than the characters that were created back when you didn't have to make sense of things.
Right.
And in a lot of ways, what I love about the Marvel movies is that they adapted a lot of the sensibilities of the Ultimates with a lot of the wonder and fun and just, you know, let's just go with it attitude of the old original comics. But when the Ultimates was launched, their Nick Fury was a dead ringer for Samuel L. Jackson with an eye patch.
Not David Hasselhoff?
Not David Hasselhoff. With apologies to Andrew, nothing at all like David Hasselhoff, and nothing at all like the Nick Fury in the regular mainstream Marvel, who, by my calculation, will be pushing 100 now. Because he was no spring chicken when he led the Howling Commandos and had two eyes.
All right, Cole.
Yeah.
Let's move it on. I'm going to ask you a thing. I'm going to ask you a question. You've got one Marvel character you can pick, one DC character you can pick. They've never had a film made. Their own standalone film. Who do you pick?
Okay. I'll go with the DC first because the Marvel is going to get me no end of grief from Andrew.
Yeah.
Let me give that a bit of a think here. With DC, this is going to be an odd choice because it's a character that wasn't originally created by DC but later owned by them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be a fun character to explore in a film because if Warner can let go of trying to make all of their movies dark, I think Blue mm-hmm. Beetle would be a fun character to explore.
See, I thought you would have picked Aquaman, for sure.
You know, I thought I would have too. I'd love Aquaman, but I don't see, honestly, a standalone feature. That's a tough character to sell. I mean, even if you brought him like a kick-ass villain like Black Manta, it's mm-hmm. still a lot to try to digest cinematically. Unless, of course, you had like some JLA films under your belt.
Yeah, but no one would have thought Green Lantern would have got his own film 2 years back, or a year or so back.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think they just missed all the... It had so much potential, and they kept going in the wrong directions.
It was overbloated in the budget to begin with. All right, so you'd say Blue Beetle. Who are you going with Marvel?
Yeah, so I think Blue Beetle would be fun because Night Owl from Watchmen is actually based on Blue Beetle.
Okay.
When DC bought the Charlton characters, which mm-hmm. were Blue Beetle, The Question, Peacemaker, I believe Nightshade is her name, Judo Master, and another one who escapes me at the moment. They basically turned those characters over to Alan Moore to write a tale to kind of get them into the mainstream DCU.
Mm.
And when they got what would become Watchmen, it was like, okay, whoa, hold your horses there, son. We'd like to actually keep most, if not all of them alive.
Mm.
It would have so drastically altered or killed off so many of the characters that they literally retooled in the spirit of those characters. Like The Question, who is a character who, you know, wears a suit and a pair of gloves and a tie and everything, and he's like the spirit, only he wears a faceless mask. So,
okay.
So his face is just a complete blank, no features, no nose, no eyes, no mouth. Became Rorschach.
Mm-hmm.
So you took that basically. In many ways, it became a better character. Peacemaker inspired the comedian. Blue Beetle, Night Owl. Blue Beetle has a big bug ship he flies around in. Is very acrobatic. And one of the things I think that Blue Beetle will be a lot of fun because he has the kind of classic old school witty banter when he goes to battle.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's really more a brainy scientist than a brawler. And I think if mm-hmm. you explored that as, you know, the witty banter being kind of a coping mechanism for, you know, I'm actually out here beating bad guys up. What the hell am I thinking?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a genius. I'm a technological genius. I don't need to be out, like, bloodying my knuckles. So I'm going to have fun with it. Marvel. I'm going to go very obscure, and unless you listen to a lot of Hey Kids comics, and very much an eye roller for Andrew. And I'm going to go with Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu, because 20, 25 years ago, I would have cast Jackie Chan as Shang-Chi. Or I should say,
you gotta look at the
deadly hands of Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu.
Yeah, but you've got to look at it this way, Cole. All right? I pose a question to you saying, who would you pick? So it's strictly your choice, but you got to look at the marketability of these guys in film. Who the hell knows Blue Beetle? Who the hell knows this Shang-Chi, whatever his name is?
Yeah. I think of the two, Shang-Chi would stand the better chance because you've got some sort of, you know, martial arts genre to drag people into the theaters. Mm. I mean, I realize, you know, marketability is going to be the biggest detractor. So, you know, mentioning the non-marketability of an Aquaman feature film out of the gate was probably not a good idea when I was going to follow it with unmarketable characters. But if you explored Shang-Chi, especially in the Master Kung Fu stories that came toward the tail end of the run, back before it could have got really bad, the fun thing with that was is it somewhere in his history, maybe from the beginning, I don't have enough back issues yet to know, they interwove the story of this character who was essentially just Marvel's answer to Bruce Lee back when Kung Fu fighting was really the shit.
Carl Douglas.
And over time, and in the hands of some really good writers, he actually became a more developed character. And somewhere along the line, they interwove his story and history with Sax Rohmer's Fu Manchu tales.
Mm-hmm.
And so Shang-Chi's father is Fu Manchu in a very Darth Vader, Luke Skywalker kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really started telling some very compelling stories in like the last several years of that series that I thought would make dynamite movie, because it was more than just like, you know, martial arts guy goes out and beats up martial arts bad guys, because you had that sci-fi element in there and a sci-fan element for that matter for you fans of Fu Manchu. Or his dog, Fu Manchisu.
Oh, dear.
And I can't think of a better place to wrap than that, but I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, just quickly, Aquaman did have a one-episode pilot, didn't it?
It did indeed. In fact, the actor whose name escapes me at the moment, who would go on to play Oliver Queen / Green Arrow in Smallville, was actually Aquaman in that pilot. He was going to be your television Aquaman, and I guess they decided to throw him a bone since that went away and give him the Green Arrow role. Because they didn't give the role to the guy that played Aquaman in Smallville.
On television?
What's that?
Is the television show Arrow Green Arrow? Was that something different altogether?
Yes, that is. Arrow is Green Arrow. And in fact, I'm told that after, if I can choke down the first handful of episodes, it really starts to have some stuff fanboys can hang their hat on.
Yeah, I was going to say, Bates Motel, a television show based on Norman Psycho.
Yeah.
Crap. Terrible.
You're not the first person who told me that.
Oh, I sat through the first four, and it was just a struggle. I mean, same with Breaking Bad. I watched the first. It's like, very well acted, but it's just not for me. So people, if you hear this, get the fuck off my back. I'm not going to watch it again. I don't hate it. It is just not for me. So, let go. Okay, stop the name calling and shit.
See, that's the sort of acerbic hatred I was looking for on this show.
It'll come. with us. That's all.
But the nice thing is this allows us to go full circle on this episode, because that's the kind of just no way in hell attitude out of the gate you had for Thor, and probably with good reason when we were discovered that Chris Hemsworth was a soap opera actor to begin with.
And a bad one at that as well.
Yeah, it's rather like when, you know, the Flash TV series was coming out in the States and you found out John Leslie Shipp was fresh off of some soap opera like All My Children or General Hospital or one of those. I'm not really sure which.
God.
And then it turned out the Flash show was pretty decent, except for the fact that they were terrified of making it about anything DCU. So, you know.
Yeah.
And here we are a couple of years later, and you're pissing me off because you get to go see Thor: The Dark World before I do.
I've heard a review from one of the radio film reviewers, and he said it was a bit of a ho-hum affair, like a middling sort of thing. But I mean, yeah, Cole, if it's any consolation, I only go to the theater or the cinema once a year. So, yeah, this is my one trip to the cinema for 2013.
Yeah, there we go.
Not been this year.
That's not a bad appraisal, then.
I would go watch it. Yeah, you want to sling me $20? I'll go watch it gladly. But if you expect me to pay that ridiculous amount of money to go watch a film, no. I want to know that I'm going to enjoy, or I know the subject fairly well enough to have confidence to go and watch it. And like I said, Thor, I knew, and I was pleasantly surprised how much I liked the first one. So I will, you know, venture out. Last year, I 99% of it until I got to the last 5 minutes and everything became crystal clear and thought it was brilliant. And still do.
And which film was that?
Dark Knight Rises last year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, so, I had another jumble in the audio there, so that will be an edit point.
That's all right. But, yeah, I'll go watch Thor and, yeah.
Well, you know, I think as we go into the conclusion here, I do want to point out, you know, you're talking about the horrendous prices for movie tickets in Australia, and I can't help but wonder if maybe the dynamic for the theater, the actual theater owners, is different than it is here.
In what manner?
Well, here, the odd thing, you know, the running joke, as far back as I can remember, is just how horrendously expensive the concessions are at movie theaters. Like, you know, a big popcorn and two drinks is like $20 or something like that.
Okay. Yeah, it's about the same here.
Well, the reason for that here is that, let's say a movie ticket costs $10.
Mm.
About, I don't know the exact amount, but it's something like 8 or 9 of those $10 goes to the studio.
Yeah, the movie theaters get next to nothing.
So I can't help but wonder if in Australia, are they just like getting more money out of each ticket, or is it that it's just that much more horrendously expensive for the theater to get the damn thing?
Well, what I can't understand was, and I was thinking about the other day, is why are tickets so expensive here? I mean, we are the most expensive country in the world. That's been determined. We are the most expensive country in the world for movie tickets. But what got me was that I thought, okay, maybe it's to do with shipping to Australia. Do that. They use a digital file which is beamed from wherever. It's like downloading a file. They'll download a digital file, run it, obviously, before it actually airs on the first day of release, run it to make sure there's nothing wrong with it, and then just go from there. So it's costing them nothing.
Yeah, I think in this day and age, at this point, it's sort of entrenched, where the ticket prices have been pretty well set, even though it's a lot easier now than it used to be, because you're not paying to ship big, heavy reels of crap.
No, you're not, but what I hear is the reason why they're charging a lot of money for tickets here is because they're trying to recoup the money they've spent on digital projection and the like. But you can't keep doing those prices forever. They'll have to come down at some point, or otherwise the cinema's going to die.
Oh, yeah, because nobody's going to go.
Back in the early 90s when I was still single and I worked across the road from the cinema up in the city. And I was going, I think I clocked up about 60-something movies in a year, easily. Because tickets were like $8 and it didn't cost nothing. I was always going to any new release basically came out. If it half grabbed my interest, I'd go watch it.
So you were like the Australian Rick back then.
My butt in the seat.
It was just like you went off an image off a poster. I was like, well, it looks all right. It's only a few bucks. I've got nothing to do. I live on my own. So, shit, why not go out and watch it? But now it's like I've got to be really, really picky. The window between theatrical release to home video is so short. I mean, it's about 3-4 months.
That's a cinema killer there.
There's going to be a time when, and I don't know when, but there's going to be a time when you can have the option of having the film streamed into your house the same day Yeah. But it'll happen. And I hate to say it, cinema / theaters, whatever you want to call them, are going to fade away. They're going to die. I mean, that's not a good sign.
No, not at all. The thing that I love, though, is now locally, I'm going to be bragging on Texas a bit, and I guess the one or two other states that have one of these, is we finally got an Alamo Drafthouse cinema near enough to us. So there's actually one in the Dallas-Fort Worth area now, and the two things that make the Alamo Drafthouse cinema brilliant, and I think this is the thing that's going to make them survive when others start to struggle, is one, they have a very strict no talking during the film, no talking, no texting, no shit during the film. They'll warn you one time, and if you ignore that, then you're kicked out of the theater. They're doing something that theaters are afraid to do, and that's respect the bulk of the audience over a single member of the audience.
Oh, yeah.
And they'll do it, have done it.
Yeah, I applaud the Alamo Drafthouse for having that strict no talking policy.
Well, the other thing that's so cool about them is that they produce their own pre-show show, effectively. So when, like, we went down, back when Avengers came out, we went down to Austin and saw the premiere, and they had a whole thing beforehand with, like, you know, anything they could find, like some of the old cartoons and, you know, fan-made stuff and all kinds of crazy cool stuff that they'd found on the internet and such. And, like, what else did I see there? We went and saw Argo in Austin, and they actually showed old news footage from back during the Iran hostage crisis. And for the most recent, we saw in Dallas when we finally got over to that one, Don John. And the hilarious, brilliant stuff they pulled out for that one. So this has been exactly what I was hoping for, which is just kind of, as best I can from 8,000 miles away or 9,000 miles away, hang out with my incredibly good friend, Stu.
Thank you for having me on. And you guys got your real load of BS here. This is a non-linear, nonsensical usual conversation Colin and I have.
That's right. And I think that's the approach we're going to try to take with the show is one or the other of us will just throw out some, you know, core topic and see how far away just by nature we get from. So I bring up Thor the Dark World and you get this whole sort of treatise on our feelings about comics and cinema and some idiot using her cell phone during Exorcist 3.
I'll tell you one thing, though. If we ever do a topic on food, which I guarantee we will, we won't be straying too far from that. I'll be bringing us back around to food. That I can talk about for hours on end.
Oh, yeah,
we
have lots to talk about. No, not in the least the abomination, the international abomination that is the Outback Steakhouse. So we'll
Don't even start me on that one. I'm having a good day today. Don't you dare start me on that.
That's why we'll talk about that another day. One day when you're just, like, really pissed off and you've had the worst day, that's when we'll talk about food because it'll take your mind off of it until I mention that place. So I don't yet know how often we're going to publish these. This is going to be probably as random and sporadic as the conversation. But thank you, Stu, for spending part of your day just hanging out and goofing off with me. This has been a treat.
Oh, yeah, it's lots of fun.
And I hope that those who tuned in enjoyed this. It's kind of a little insight, as Stu said, into how it gets when he and I get talking. Probably very reminiscent of how any of this goes when any number of us get talking to each other.
Random marathon conversations.
That's right. So tune in again soon. Just kind of watch the JCU. And if you see BS with SB show up, it's a new episode. Thank you and good night.